Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We're going to put you through your paces on taxes today, also on the minimum wage. But hey, there are going to be donuts at the end. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 25th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. On the theory that it's possibly escaped your notice, this is tax week in the American economy. Both congressional Republicans and the White House have promised they will be filling in the blanks on their proposals to overhaul the Internal Revenue Code Wednesday, we are told. Not being one to wait for formal announcements, though, President Trump answered a couple of tax questions yesterday on his way back to Washington from his place in New Jersey. The president said he hopes to cut the maximum individual tax rate to somewhere around 10-12%. Maximum rate, that's what the president said. That rate is 39.5% now, so as you can imagine, that caught our attention. We called the White House to double check, if you will, and they said the president was actually, it turns out, talking about the minimum tax bracket, which is already at 10%. You confused? Welcome to the bracketology of tax reform. We asked Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson to clear things up for us.
In a word, lowering the top personal rate from about 40% to about 10% would be
ridiculous.
Joe Rosenberg with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. President Trump was supposedly talking about the lowest tax bracket. We know that now. Rosenberg thinks he was also referencing an earlier proposal that would take the 7 existing tax brackets and collapse them down to 3, with rates of 10%, 25%, and 35%. He's crunched the numbers on that proposal.
We estimate it would reduce revenues by about $2 trillion over 10 years.
That's just an estimate because we don't know yet what incomes those brackets will apply to and what else these reforms might change. The president's scheduled to give more details in a speech Wednesday.
Taxpayers in the middle of the income distribution might see a tax cut of around $700 a year. It was closer to $40,000 for taxpayers in the top 1%.
Just dropping the top tax by nearly 5 percentage points, changing nothing else, would cut federal tax revenues by about $500 billion over 10 years, according to Scott Greenberg with the Tax Foundation.
That's a pretty big number in the context of some of the tax changes that we're talking about for reform. For instance, some Republican lawmakers have floated the idea of reducing tax revenue by $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years.
In other words, lowering the top tax bracket would be about a third of those total proposed cuts. Even though the president said as recently as last week that the wealthy wouldn't gain at all from the reforms. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
It is terrible in Puerto Rico right now, and by all accounts, it's going to be terrible for a very long time to come. A week after Hurricane Maria left the island flooded and completely without power, as of this morning, nearly 3 million Americans on that island still don't have electricity, and damage to the broader Puerto Rican economy is becoming more clear. An economy that, as we have reported, has been in deep trouble for a long time already. The American pharmaceutical industry is paying close attention. More than a quarter of all the drugs we export are made in Puerto Rico. So the companies that operate more than 50 plants and distribution centers on the island are trying to recover, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
Puerto Rico has been a pharma hotspot since the 1970s, thanks to tax breaks for the industry. Nicolette Lewis-Saint runs Healthcare Ready, a national nonprofit that works on healthcare disaster response. She says the island plays a big role in the pharmaceutical supply chain, and not just as a manufacturer,
but also as a central point of distribution for the rest of the Caribbean.
Where she says people have been through a lot this hurricane season and can't afford disruptions in their prescription drug supply. But Lewis-Saint says shortages may not be in the cards because drug makers plan for disasters like these.
Hurricane season comes every year. Companies are very aware of the particular hazards that they have to contend with, and they have business continuity plans in place.
They've stockpiled generator fuel, developed emergency staffing plans, and are quickly moving drugs that have already been made off the island to maintain quality. But long-term damage to Puerto Rico's pharmaceutical industry is a possibility. Analyst David Hitchcock at S&P Global Ratings says the tax benefits that built the island's pharmaceutical industry were phased out in 2006.
Since then, the pharmaceutical plant have decreased in number. Pharmaceutical companies are not adding new plants. And as plants get taken offline, they have not been replaced. And that's been part of Puerto Rico's economic problems.
Hitchcock says this trend could continue in the aftermath of Maria. As drug makers assess the damage, some may take the opportunity to close down operations there altogether. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
I saw an interesting quote this morning about the German election this past weekend, that it meant the end of German economic exceptionalism. That is probably an overstatement, but now fourth-term Chancellor Angela Merkel does have her hands full as she starts trying to build a new governing coalition. Merkel and her Christian Democrats got the most votes, as you know, but the centrist parties lost millions who defected to the anti-Islamic, anti-immigration alternative for Deutschland, AfD it's called. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard considers the economic fallout of that vote.
The Alternative for Deutschland Party, or AfD, ran on issues of immigration, Islam and German identity. But AfD spokesperson Beatrix von Storck makes clear the party has wider aims. It has a strong anti-EU, anti-Euro agenda.
We want to have a Europe of nation states. We want to keep our sovereignty. And when it comes to Euro rescue policy, everyone wants that we pay for our neighbors' debts. We don't want that.
From inside Parliament for the first time, the AfD might galvanize German opposition to another Greek bailout. It'll certainly protest vociferously against the closer economic integration that France is proposing to shore up the euro. But protest is all the AfD will achieve, claims one of Angela Merkel's ministers, Peter Altmaier.
I can see no political party willing to cooperate with the far right in Germany, so they will be pretty much isolated.
Nevertheless, says Carsten Brzeski of ING Bank in Berlin, the AfD's breakthrough has shaken investors' confidence in Europe's safest pair of hands.
I think even though the international world still sees Merkel as the stability anchor, she has become a weaker stability anchor.
The election result has, for now, shattered the reassuringly dull and predictable nature of German politics. Populism has raised its head in Europe's most important economy. I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
What's that you say? Where's the healthcare news, Kai? Well, the thing is, there isn't really any healthcare news. Senate Republicans are still looking for votes for Graham Cassidy, offering this benefit or that to no voters. But hey, don't feel bad. Even the Congressional Budget Office can't keep up. The preliminary score they're working on for that bill, it's already out of date. Sweeteners are being added to the thing so fast. Today's ticker symbol of note is FB. No guesses, please. Too easy. Facebook got clobbered down 4.5% today, took the NASDAQ down with it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Trump administration's out with a new travel ban, as you might have heard last night, is when it came out. 8 countries in this one, including Chad, Venezuela, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. Up next, immigration-wise, is a new cap on refugees. Announcement coming sometime in the next couple of days, apparently. One city that's going to be watching real closely, Lincoln, Nebraska. Nebraska has per capita more refugees than any other state in the country. Many of them are from the Middle East and often include Yazidis, a not all that familiar religious minority from Iraq. For them, Lincoln has become something of a second home, as Marketplace's Rima Crace reports.
This story begins at a place that has very little to do with beginnings.
We've been told that 145 graves can fit there.
Khalaf Heso has brought me to the first national cemetery for Yazidis, located just a few miles outside of Lincoln on a hilltop overlooking the city. Last year, Heso and other Yazidis pooled $150,000 to build the cemetery. The 20-acre plot is still mostly weeds and dirt with just a few grave sites. But Heso says,
when they saw a lot of their cemeteries getting demolished back home, by ISIS. Everybody were desperate to establish a Yazidi cemetery for just Yazidis.
Yazidis are a tiny group, fewer than a million around the world, most of them from northern Iraq. They've long faced persecution for their faith, which pulls elements from different religions. Since 2014, ISIS has captured and murdered thousands of Yazidis in what the United Nations has recognized as genocide.
My family was the first Yazidi family to move here. 1997, that's when they came to Lincoln.
At least they were among the first. A decade later, Lincoln started resettling Yazidis in large numbers, many of them translators for the U.S. Army. Today, Nebraska's capital is home to the largest Yazidi community in the U.S., 3,000 and growing. Many of those refugees were drawn to the city for its affordable rents and safe neighborhoods.
Most of them, including me, see Nebraska as their, you know, their town that they're going to be at for the rest of their life.
Heso, who's 34 and, yes, a Cornhusker fan, works as a Kurdish and Arabic interpreter. He says many Yazidis, when they first arrive, have to take low-wage jobs at places like McDonald's and Walmart. But as they settle into the community...
A lot of them, I know, start having their own businesses, like barbershop, selling and trading cars.
There was a bakery that I just went to.
Bakery, yeah. What is that called, the name?
It's called Turkish Sweets, and its owner just turned 20.
My name is Safwan, and my last name is Kaidi.
The bakery is off a main road, part of a strip of immigrant-owned businesses in Lincoln. There are just a few tables, but the cases are full of baklava, cookies, and cakes.
I have like 70 different kind of cookies.
And what's your favorite sweet?
I don't eat sweet.
Wait, you don't eat sweets and you own a bakery?
I just tested. I don't like to eat.
Kaidi learned to bake while he was a refugee in Turkey, but he spent his first 2 years in Lincoln doing factory work and washing dishes at a buffet restaurant before he had enough money to start his own business. The worst part of those jobs, he says, dealing with a boss.
The United States? Oh my God. It's like supervisor and team leader. Just I want to work like only me.
Hassan Khalil gets that. 3 years ago, he opened the Golden Scissor Barbershop and Salon.
Are you ready for the scissor part? Scissor part is really easy.
Today, he's giving a nervous kindergarten boy a haircut. Khalil's own hair is hidden under a Yankees cap. As a teen, he and his family were resettled to New York. But he missed the friends he'd grown up with in refugee camps. And in 2010, moved to Lincoln.
Just coming over here and seeing the corn farms and kind of remind me a little bit of back home, a lot of open space.
Lincoln's big Yazidi community feels like home in other ways, too. Khalil is a musician, and between the buzz cuts and fades, he practices traditional songs in the corner of his shop.
I'm in a group, so we do weddings, we do like birthday parties.
It's a way to make extra money, he says, but also...
Music is like my passion. It's been ever since I remember. My dad played a Kurdish long neck guitar and he sings. My daughter's getting into it.
Once he's done with the kindergartner, Khalil congratulates him for being such a good sport.
Good job, bro. High five.
The boy heads out the door. Khalil heads to the other side of his shop and sits down at his keyboard. In Lincoln, Nebraska, I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, there are 7,000 Dunkin' Donut locations worldwide. The donut is an icon. It's not going anywhere.
Especially when you add fried chicken to the menu, let me tell you. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go on a Monday at the end of September. The Dow Industrial's off 53 points today, just shy of 0.25%, 22,296 for the blue chips. NASDAQ off 56 points, 0.8%, 63.70. The S&P 500 gave back 5, 0.2%, 24.96. Tech stocks led the retreat. Facebook, we told you about, down 4.5%, fourth straight day of declines. The company is getting unwanted attention, shall we say, for its ad targeting practices and purchases of advertising by faked accounts linked to Russia. Also, the company abandoned a plan for new share structure meant to protect Mark Zuckerberg's control of that company. Google declined just about 1%. Amazon down 1.6%. Today, General Electric agreed to sell its industrial solutions business to Switzerland's ABB Limited for $2.6 billion. What are industrial solutions? Unit makes electrical equipment for utilities, apparently. GE's new CEO is working to cut costs and streamline the company's business. Interesting, coming from America's most iconic conglomerate. GE up 1% on that news. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, some more taxes now because, well, it's taxes, right? The GOP is interested in cutting them, as you know. And so far, we are not entirely clear how or actually whether congressional Republicans and the White House plan to pay for them so as to avoid blowing up the debt and deficit. We've been told almost all deductions are on the table, including the deduction that homeowners can take it for the interest they pay on their mortgages, which is as old as the tax code itself. But in perhaps a sign of what's to come, as Congress tries to rewrite the Internal Revenue Code for the first time in a generation, the mortgage deduction lobbyists are ready to go. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that one.
When I finally put my key in the door at night, I couldn't be happier to be home. And I'm not the only one who's glad. There are also legions of plumbers, carpenters, contractors, and bankers who are happy that I'm in this house, and each of them has something to lose if the mortgage interest deduction goes away. So industry lobbyists are geared up to make sure it doesn't.
The National Association of Realtors, the National Association of Home Builders, the Mortgage Bankers Association.
That's Sheila Klumholz, head of the Center for Responsive Politics. She tracks disclosure reports from lobbyists that detail what they're spending and what they're spending on.
Those are the top organizations lobbying this year and spending big.
Klumholz says the National Association of Realtors was the second biggest spender on Capitol Hill during the first half of this year, right behind the Chamber of Commerce. The Realtors dropped a cool $20 million, not unusual for them.
Our expenditures so far this year have been quite normal.
That's Jamie Gregory, the Realtors' deputy chief lobbyist. He says they're just getting started. If Congress actually tries to kill or cap the mortgage deduction, Gregory says they'll unleash more cash. And money wouldn't be their only weapon. They've got homeowners.
I think that once Congress hears from homeowners, you know, the 73 million, 75 million homeowners out there, I think things may change.
Gregory argues that the mortgage interest deduction is one of the biggest incentives to buy a home. Take it away and...
obviously, sales volume will drop.
And if sales volume drops...
valuations will drop.
And Gregory says...
there would be a very detrimental effect on the economy in general.
Congress is plenty familiar with this argument. It helped save the mortgage interest deduction the last time lawmakers tried to eliminate it in the 90s. No one's saying history will repeat itself. Certainty is not a big commodity in Washington these days. Plus, the deduction, which amounts to around $68 billion a year, has its detractors. Some economists, like this guy.
Personally, I would favor eventually getting rid of it.
Bill Gale is co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He and other economists say the mortgage interest deduction is regressive, favoring the richest taxpayers, and it encourages people to buy more house than they need or can afford. But Gale says briefing papers are no match for cash.
There's a difference between saying there are policy advocates arguing that the mortgage deduction is inefficient and inequitable and expensive, and lobbyists saying, you know, we donate a lot to your campaign and we want to keep the mortgage interest deduction.
Lobbyists like to do the briefing paper thing, too. The National Association of Realtors says it ran the numbers, and they showed that just over half of homeowners who claimed the mortgage interest deduction in 2015 made less than $100,000. Don't worry about keeping track of all these arguments. You'll be hearing them again and again and again as Congress debates tax reform. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The restaurant business can be tricky, but of all the menus you could choose to offer, you'd think donuts and fried chicken would be pretty basic, especially when you and your partners are already in the restaurant business. Alas, not so for Mike Solomonov and Stephen Cook, restaurateurs who, with some friends, opened Federal Donuts in Philadelphia in 2011. Donuts, it seems, are harder than they look, and running a donut shop is a whole different deal than running a more conventional restaurant. The saga is told in their new book. It's called Federal Donuts, The Partially True Spectacular Story. Guys, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
I have to tell you, based on the first couple of chapters of this book, it's kind of amazing that Federal Donuts got off the ground. There was a comedy of errors thing going on here.
I thought you were going to say it's amazing that you guys have a book.
Yeah, that they printed it.
Well, that too. You know.
Yeah, I mean, we really just sort of backed into it. We didn't have very high expectations for it at all. And as we say in the book, we sort of just wrote off the investment immediately.
Really?
In our minds. In my mind, anyways.
We thought it was going basically into the wood-burning oven at our restaurant. It was just finished.
Wow. We should say here, Mike, that you're a chef of some repute. I mean, you're a name guy.
Yeah.
No, something I mean, you like are. That. Don't give me the, oh, yeah. I mean, you are. There's like James Beard Awards and all kinds of write-ups and, you know.
He's very modest, but he is the man.
Well, so, Mike, I'm not going to let you go on this one. Why donuts after a literally an award-winning career in regular restaurants?
I mean, I think that, like, so here's the deal about chefs, famous chefs, right? There's no individual.
Oh, now you're a famous chef?
I'm just, you know.
Didn't take him very long to warm up to that.
That's right.
Yeah, I usually make people kiss the pinky ring before I even say that. But here's the deal, right? We can sit and come up with formulas and talk and rationalize what works and what doesn't work with restaurants. But the truth of the matter is, a hit is very random. Zahav worked. We opened a couple other restaurants in 2008 and 2009 when, you know, the economy wasn't doing so well. We didn't want to go back to a bank and go back to our groups of friends and family and people that were stupid enough to give us money to open up these businesses when we weren't so confident in what we were doing. And the Federal Donuts came across very organically. And as Steve said, we just kind of like threw together money that we weren't that concerned about losing, and it worked.
To be able to get back to why we got into this business in the first place, to have fun and only be worried about making great donuts and fried chicken and not being worried about the finances of it was really liberating.
Steve, are you guys worried at all about, I mean, donuts are hot right now, right? And they're very hip and they're casual and they're fun and all this jazz. And there are places here in L.A. that are sort of like Federal Donuts, except the L.A. version. How much do you worry about the donut bubble?
It's a question. It's one of the most common questions that we get asked. I mean, I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but when we first started out and people were comparing us to cupcakes, I just looked and said, you know, there are 7,000 Dunkin' Donut locations worldwide. The donut is an icon. It's not going anywhere. We've also got, like, our donuts are not too highbrow. I mean, we don't sort of fetishize it. We just try to make a really solid donut, and I think people always want that.
Steve, it seems to me that the franchising possibilities here are endless and that we could see Federal Donuts in, like, L.A. in 18 months. What do you think?
You got a location?
L.A.'s big. We could find some room.
We talk about it all the time, and we have. We just opened a Federal Donuts in Miami, so we are dipping our toes in those waters. I think, you know, back 10 years ago, nobody would answer our phone calls. That was the biggest hurdle to us growing. Now the biggest hurdle is, you know, so many opportunities and how to be wise about expansion. We're living in an age where the restaurant business, there's so much money flowing in. And the beauty of Federal Donuts is that the financial success really came second. So we want to be very careful about our expansion and not lose whatever that magic is that we found 5 years ago.
But L.A., we love. I mean, we love Southern California. It would be totally sick. I'm wearing a Hawaiian t-shirt as we speak and thinking about surfing. You know, I think that donuts and fried chicken would be embraced, obviously, or has been embraced in Southern California.
So what are you? Are you a chef or an entrepreneur?
I don't know. I don't know what I am. I'm not sure. Steve, what are you? Yeah. Steve's like, everyone thinks that Steve, because he was in finance before and is considerably smarter than me, he's like the money guy. But I'm like, we bleed and suffer the same. Huh. What are you, Steve? Are you a chef?
I hope not.
Stephen Cook and Mike Solomonov, partners with a couple of three other people in Federal Donuts and some other places in Philadelphia, PA. You guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks
so much. Thank you.
We got a bunch of recipes from that book, Donuts and Fried Chicken, too, up at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, branding is everything, political edition. Maine Senator Angus King has written to the Unicode Consortium, the group that in a roundabout kind of way is in charge of emojis. He has a request. King wants a lobster emoji, which it turns out there currently isn't, I guess. Because no existing emoji accurately captures the species, King wrote, it would complete a set of emoji representing crustaceans commonly consumed as food items, and it would respond to significant public demand. End of quote. I don't know about lobster emoji demand, but it is true that in 2016, Maine lobstermen brought in 130 million pounds of said crustacean. All right, from New York on an unseasonably warm Monday, we're out of here. The Dow off 53 points today, just shy of 1%. NASDAQ off 56, 0.8%. Thank you, Facebook. S&P 500 gave back about 5 points, 0.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garoba, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.